Hey y'all, how's it going? I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. Welcome to it. ScottHorton.org is my website if you like going to websites and stuff. I know I make it sound really exciting, don't I? Check it out! ScottHorton.org. Keep all my interview archives there for you. More than 3,000 of them now, going back to 2003. And also, you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at /ScottHortonShow. Oh, yeah. Did I mention the chat room? Join up the chat room if you like chat rooms. That's at scotthorton.org/chat. Hang out with the guys in there. Yeah. And you can like me and retweet me and repost my videos at /ScottHortonShow. Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, /ScottHortonShow. All right. So, I don't know. Got a lot to talk about. I guess first I'll tell you what's going to be on the show today. Me talking and also asking questions of Patrick Coburn. And also Scott McConnell. That should be good stuff. I don't know if you saw it. Patrick Coburn's latest piece is about the road from Damascus. That Patrick Coburn, if you have a war, he'll show up at it and report on the thing. He doesn't, you know, act like me, sit safe and sound back in Texas criticizing. No, he goes to the front line and then criticizes from there. Good old Patrick Coburn. That guy, he doesn't play around at all. You look at his profile picture there on independent.co.uk. Yeah, this guy is all business. Journalism is his business. And yeah, he's going to be on the show to talk about the horror show, the absolute nightmare that is the war in Syria right now. Of course, to a great degree because of the actions and policies of the United States government. Just because it's too far away to be America's business doesn't mean that our government hasn't gone ahead and made it our business anyway. Of course, they have. Not that I'm justifying further intervention. Just explaining that even though you're going Syria, I don't even know where Syria is. A lot of you, come on. Some of you. It doesn't mean that your government isn't up to all of our eyebrows in the conflict of what's going on there. All right. And then, Scott McConnell's going to be here to talk about what he calls America's entirely self-inflicted Ukraine disaster in the pages of the American Conservative magazine. And that should be good as well. Good old Scott McConnell back on the show. All right. So, I guess I'm going to save my Ukraine stuff for the McConnell interview. And try to, you know, do like Jeopardy and put it in the form of a question. I'm sure I'll fail at that, but whatever. Have a conversation with Scott McConnell all about that. And so I'll skip back to Jonathan Landay. And he's got help. I'm not saying he doesn't have help. Ollie Watkins and Marissa Taylor on this one. He's had help, I guess, all week from these two and I don't know who else. But anyway, Landay, he's the star over there in McClatchy Newspapers. If you've been paying attention to him in 2002, there never would have been a war in Iraq because he debunked it all. Him and Warren Strobel for Knight Ridder. And I ain't saying he's perfect on everything, Libya, but man, he's a hell of a great reporter. And here he is all week long. He's been breaking the story of the breaking and developing the story of the CIA spying on the Senate Intelligence Committee, their oversight committee. And spying on them for what? For doing their job. And working on a torture report. That is a report on the history of the CIA's quite illegal, quite criminal torture program. And the CIA has been doing everything they can to obstruct this thing for a long time now. The report's been ready for more than half a year. It's 6,300 pages long, they say, put together by the staff of the Senate Intelligence Committee. And the CIA has been crying that, oh no, we dispute every footnote. We dispute every dotted I and every cross T. Nuh-uh, that didn't happen. No, that didn't happen that way. Just fake fighting about as much as they possibly can, trying to delay or perhaps, indefinitely delay. Is that still a delay if it's indefinite? To try to stop the publishing of this report. And so what's happened, though, is they found a Panetta report. It's still in dispute how it was the Senate staff got their hands on this, whether the CIA gave it to them deliberately, whether the CIA gave it to them accidentally, or whether they somehow stole it from those whose it's their job to oversee. Anyway, not that I can talk good, but I'm still right. Anyway, so this Panetta report is an internal CIA report, which reportedly, and I think quite believably, they're saying it bolsters the Senate version of the history of the CIA's torture program. It does not bolster the CIA's version in all of the points of fact which they're attempting to dispute. Big surprise. And so now in this case, the latest, this led to, of course, Dianne Feinstein's speech before the Senate, where she complained about the violation of the separation of powers. She complained about a CIA lawyer who's one of the torture lawyers who she says is mentioned more than 1,000 times, I think 1,600 times in the torture report. He's the one who went and filed a complaint with the Department of Justice against the Senate staff, which is what I think really got her angry, that, you know, these are people who she's sworn to protect their role as in the oversight, whatever. And she said she took that as just blatant attempted intimidation by the CIA of her staff, and she was not going to put up with that. And you don't have to like anything about Dianne Feinstein at all to appreciate the fact of what her role is compared to what their role is supposed to be in our society. She's the boss of them, and their job is to turn over what she says turn over. And for them to try to level a criminal complaint against her staff clearly is them trying to intimidate and encroach upon her authority over them. And anyway, so now we find out the White House has been holding almost 10,000 documents themselves. 9,000 and something, wait, they say here. It was at McClatchyDC.com. 9,400 documents that the committee apparently used to have access to that the White House has now come and sealed off. Not that they've claimed executive privilege, which I guess would be the end of that if they claimed executive privilege. But they haven't even gotten around to that. And it's 10,000 pages, and I guess the implication here is, and I read it really fast before the show, rather than thoroughly long before the show, but I think the implication here is that the Senate report, which we're talking about whether it should be declassified or not, which John Brennan, the head of the CIA, and Barack Obama both claim they want it declassified, as though their wish isn't the command of the guy with the rubber stamp. Give me a break. That's what it means for something to be declassified. Either under the statute, there's a time limit on it or something, or the will of the chief executive says so. That's it. That's all it takes for Obama to release this report is for him to say, it is hereby released. Release it. And that's it. It's done. That's what it means. Chief executive. Anyway. Apparently he doesn't call all the shots over there, but come on, he could release the damn report. Well, I want it released. Well, release it then. What the hell is that? But now it turns out this report apparently is not based on, it does not include information in this other 10,000 pages, or I don't know, pages. Another 10,000 documents totaling however many pages, we don't know. in the hands of the White House, the National Security Council staff, that they've been keeping from the Senate, too. You see what's going on here, folks, is that torture's a crime. And there are a lot of powerful people who, according to, you know, the law, the same one that they use as their excuse to lock you up and take your money if they feel like it, according to the law, they should all have to go to prison. And it's just too big of a deal. So they don't want to tell you the truth because you might insist that the rule of law apply to those who tortured for George W. Bush. And maybe even him. May God forbid. Man, you need some new stickers for the back of your truck. Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. Aren't you sick and tired of everyone else being wrong about everything all the time? Well, now you can tell them all what's right with some stickers from LibertyStickers.com. At LibertyStickers.com, they're against everything, so you know they're good on your issue, too. Whether it's the wars, police state, gun laws, the left and right, or the president, LibertyStickers.com has hundreds of choices so you can find just the right words to express your opposition and contempt for those who would violate your rights. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for Braswell Business Communication Services at FusePowder.com. Braswell Communications can provide a credentialed media presence for your company at industry conferences and trade shows, as well as support services and consultation for publishing, editorial and technical writing, business-to-business and marketing communications, research, and information campaigns. Braswell also does website development and complete web content maintenance to include voiceover audio and copywriting. Strengthen your business. FusePowder.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton. This is the Scott Horton Show. ScottHorton.org is where I hang out sometime anyway. I keep all my stuff there. Man, I try so hard to get the stress blog up and going again, and I just... Yeah. Damn Twitter, man. All right. I'm Scott. Oh, the only thing I had left to say about the torture thing is that, well, two things. First of all, imagine unleashing Marcy Wheeler and every wannabe Marcy Wheeler out there on a 6,300-page torture report. And imagine the ripples through the society, even if they tried to black it all out on CNN still. I think that would be so good for America, you know? I mean, then again, it might provoke some more terrorist attacks. You know, the truth might provoke some more terrorist attacks, and that could be really bad for America. But, you know, the truth and the heavens fall and all of that kind of cliche sort of thing that, hey, you know, the reason our government is still able to go around enacting all these evil policies that create enemies for us is because they always get away with it. There's no accountability. There's no individual responsibility for the people who violate the rights of others and violate the law to do so under the color of government authority. And for that matter, we don't even usually, we don't even have that kind of society-wide reckoning for what was wrong. You know, it took till... You know what, till Platoon came out or something, and then it was sort of like, okay, yeah, I guess we shouldn't have done that whole Vietnam thing. But they never had a, man, that was a big mistake, sort of bad thing for a lot of people to believe in and support for a long time kind of a thing. And now the argument that everything over in Vietnam was fine except for Walter Cronkite and the liberals in the media stabbed us in the back right when we were starting to clear, hold, and build, and all this ridiculous mythology has... you know, room to grow and to become an official established counter-narrative to the Vietnam War. No, it would have been fine. We were about to win if it wasn't for the liberals stabbing us in the back, you know, like the Nazi stab in the back theory. And because there never really was a reckoning about Vietnam, that actually you didn't have the right to invade Vietnam and try to take it from the people who lived there, and they had every right to expel foreign colonialists from their land, left, right, or any other ideology aside, or notwithstanding. And it's the same kind of thing with the torture program. The truth of the matter is that somewhere on the order of 50 or even more percent of the American people were and maybe still are wrong, bad on torture. Unless, of course, what you think is that Western civilization ought to be a barbarian civilization of torturers. That really is what we stand for here, not rights. Not common decency, much less, you know, the golden rule or anything like that. So, there never was a reckoning, because what happened was when the torture scandal broke, people were still so caught up in the war fever, they were willing to sacrifice anything they ever believed in order to side with their dear leader, George W. Bush. Imagine George W. Bush leading men and men following him. Ha! To the point where I remember on San Antonio Radio, my favorite radio station on San Antonio, out of San Antonio back in the day was 5:50 a.m. I don't know if it's even still around anymore. Carl Wigglesworth and them. And they're basically kind of down-home conservative types. Nice guys. And when Abu Ghraib broke, they said, hey, you know, I don't know who all is responsible for this or whatever, but absolutely not. There's a thing called the American way. And it cannot be the American way and have room for torture in it. There's just no room for torture. We are civilized. We have a constitution. We have a rule of law. We do not torture. And if anybody in this government is torturing anybody, they got to go to prison for that. That is a crime. And is absolutely beyond the pale. And that's it. And I don't want to hear any argument about it either, because there is no argument. And then what happened? The Republican Party, and especially the neoconservative-led media, which means the editorial board of every newspaper in America, has one of these cranks. And the National Review and the Weekly Standard and just GOP talking points, Fox News, Rupert Murdoch and Roger Ailes. They said, no, we do torture, but we don't call it that, but we love it. No, it's not torture, but sometimes you gotta beat them out of it. It's beat it out of them. It's the only effective way to get the truth, to stop the ticking time bomb. And what happened? On San Antonio Radio and everywhere else on the right, they rallied around the torturers. Instead of saying, no, Roger Ailes, you're not gonna tell us to change our mind on this, pal. You can't. They said, oh, my new marching orders is that I'm for torture, then fine. And that became the consensus on the American right. This is that one little thing about torture I was going to say. And what happened was we never had that reckoning in the society. It became a partisan issue. And even when Obama came to power, he didn't really abolish torture, because that would have just taken him instructing the entire government that the law is the law. If you torture somebody, you're a criminal. Watch as I prosecute all these tortures from the Bush administration. He didn't do that. He said, first of all, as far as their accountability goes, let's look forward, not back. There is no law that can apply to George Bush or anybody who worked for him torturing people, even if he tortured them to death. That's what the Department of Justice under Eric Holder and Barack Obama decided, was that even if the CIA tortured people to death, they would not face even a criminal investigation. They faced only a preliminary investigation in two cases of murder, a preliminary investigation to see whether they would face an investigation to see whether they would face charges for torturing people to death. And the answer was no. They will not even face a criminal investigation for it. And he said, I have banned torture, meaning he signed a new executive order not binding all government officials to respect the fact that torture is already a felony. But just to basically maintain the power, retain the power for himself and any other president that comes after him. I have decided that torture will not be the current policy of this government, he said. And then, of course, with the exception that, except whatever is permissible in Appendix M of the Army Field Manual, which has been amended to include temperature manipulation, sleep manipulation. I don't know about the stress positions. I think there's some stress position stuff in there. Certainly, what used to be far beyond the bounds. But once they passed the Detainee Treatment Act, binding the military to the Army Field Manual, they had to amend the Army Field Manual to allow torture in it. And, of course, they also torture people by way of the force feedings and by way of all the psychotropic drugs and all of the cell raids, the rapid reaction force raids into the cells and other excuses to torture people at Bagram, at Guantanamo Bay, and wherever else, too. And because there's never been a reckoning here. And that's what the CIA is so desperate. That's what Obama and John Brennan are conspiring to do right now, is to keep all this covered up as much as they can. For whatever reason, Dianne Feinstein has decided she wanted to do a thorough investigation of this thing. And you know what? Maybe it is 6,300 pages of red herrings, but I don't think so. I think this is likely to be the best history, certainly so far, maybe that we could ever hope to get, of what really happened in that torture program under George W. Bush. And they're afraid that the Americans will care. And that's what's going on here. They're afraid that the people will say, you know what? Actually, we would rather have a civilization than be a bunch of barbarians just because a bunch of Republicans told us to be barbarians. Screw them. I don't care if Fox News tells me that I support torture. I still don't. Well, is that so hard? And, you know, I don't know. I wouldn't want to see anyone executed over it because I wouldn't want to see any conservative martyrs in America. But I sure would like to see Bush and Cheney and all of the principals and all of their lawyers locked in prison for life for what they've done. It was a crime, and they all knew it at the time. And that's Bush and Cheney, Colin Powell, Condoleezza Rice, John Ashcroft, who was the Attorney General at the time, George Tenet, the Director of Central Intelligence, Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense, and all of their lawyers, which means, and I'll leave some out, I'm sorry, it's not because I favor any of them over others, but that would include Addington and Haynes and Libby and Fife and of course, Judge Bybee and John Yoo and Alberto Gonzalez. And good old, what's his name from the CIA, the horrible devil who tortured people to death. Anyway, there's a whole bunch of them, the tortured team they're called in Philip Sands' book. And they're all felons. They're all guilty of torture and conspiracy to torture people. You know, they had a meeting, this is in at ABC News, it's not denied, it's been elaborated on since, in fact. The key word that you need to search is White House choreographed torture. And it's about how everybody except Bush himself was in the room. Cheney and Powell and Rumsfeld and Rice and Tenet and Ashcroft. And they were choreographing the torture of Katani down there at Guantanamo Bay. And John Ashcroft said, history, why are we doing this in the White House? History is not going to look kindly on this. Which I guess, you know, reveals that he knew that he'd never be accountable before the law, but at least this does kind of look bad, doesn't it, fellows? He asked. Don't worry about things you can't control. Isn't that what they always say? But it's about impossible to avoid worrying about what's going on these days. The government has used the war on guns, the war on drugs, and the war on terrorism to tear our Bill of Rights to shreds. But you can fight back. The 10th Amendment Center has proven it, racking up major victories. For example, when the U.S. government claimed authority in the NDAA to have the military kidnap and detain Americans without trial, the nullifiers got a law passed in California, declaring the state's refusal to ever participate in any such thing. Their latest project is offnow.org, nullifying the National Security Agency. They've already gotten model legislation introduced in California, Arizona, Oklahoma, Missouri, and Kansas, meant to limit the power of the NSA to spy on Americans in those states. We'd be fools to wait around for the U.S. Congress or courts to roll back Big Brother. Our best chance is nullification and interposition on the state level. Go to offnow.org, print out that model legislation, and get to work nullifying the NSA. The hero Edward Snowden has risked everything to give us this chance. Let's take it. Offnow.org. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for CashIntoCoins.com. So you want to buy some Bitcoins? CashIntoCoins.com makes it fast, easy, and safe to get Bitcoins. Just deposit the money into their account at any of the major banks they support, and then just email them a picture of the receipt and your Bitcoin address, and you get your Bitcoins. Almost always the same day it clears. In a tough, competitive new market, CashIntoCoins.com has the advantage. A great system and great customer service to keep you coming back. That's CashIntoCoins.com. Just click the link in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And our first guest today is one of the most important journalists in the world right now, of course. You're all very familiar, Patrick Coburn, Middle East correspondent for The Independent. That's independent.co.uk. You can also find him at counterpunch.org and at unz.com. That's UNZ.com. Primarily writes for The Independent, and also I should mention he's the author of the very important book, and I think it still remains to be seen just how important the subject will be in the future. It's called Muqtada al-Sadr, The Shia Revival, and the Future of Iraq. Welcome back to the show, Patrick. How are you doing?
Fine, thank you.
Good. Very happy to have you back on the show here, and a couple of articles at issue. Let's see, the last one before was The Nature of War Has Changed, which is bleak news for Syria's minorities. And then the latest at The Independent is Syria's Road to Hell, a hair-raising journey between Damascus and Tartus. So I guess most of us know where Damascus is. Where's Tartus? And tell us about your trip on the road from Damascus.
Well, this is a sort of crucial road for the control of Syria, one that the government and the rebels have been fighting over. Damascus, the capital, then you go north to Homs, which is the third biggest city, which has been also even more fought over. But then you go west to Tartus, which isn't so big, but it's a port on the coast. It is very supportive of the government. Its population is a large proportion are Alawites, the same Islamic sect that President Assad belongs to. So this is a sort of the road that the government dare not lose and the opposition would love to take. It also is sort of the same route is where the crude oil pipelines, the electricity pylons are. So it's important for a whole range of reasons.
I see. And then, well, and so it's funny, it doesn't sound like, as, you know, at least in terms of who holds what territory on the ground or anything like that, like the balance of power has changed much in the last year or so. Is that about right?
Yeah, I'd say, you know, really almost 18 months, it hasn't changed. The stalemate on the ground. The government's making some progress. I mean, you come out of north Damascus, and there are a series of suburbs there that are completely shattered by artillery fire, and these used to be opposition strongholds. But and it used to be that you couldn't go down that road because of snipers. And now, I mean, it looks like something like Dresden after the bombing, but you can drive down it, and we didn't get shot at, and there's quite a lot of other traffic, which means that increasingly people think that the road is safe. Then as you go north, and you have Lebanon over to your west, and there are Jabhat al-Nusra holds various villages there, including a Christian village called Malula, where they released the nuns recently that kidnapped them. And it's rather strange because the enemy, from the government's point of view, is very close to that main road. A month or so ago, they cut it at a place called Nabak. There's sort of, I think, an unofficial sort of don't shoot at me and I won't shoot at you type truce at various points. Mm-hmm. But again, the government's on the offensive there. One of the strange things about Syria at the moment is that you have places which have ceasefires, and in some cases the rebels, the Free Syrian Army, are still inside, still have their weapons, or in some cases they've simply changed sides and joined the government militia, the National Defense Force. Sometimes people in some of these ordinary Syrians are kind of a bit angry that these guys who'd come in and said, let's say they're going to fight to the end against Assad, have quite happily just switched sides, usually getting the same salary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you even talk in the article about some of these checkpoints are manned by the so-called Free Syrian Army jointly with the Damascus government.
Yeah, it's sort of strange. It's also kind of fragile, I think. Excuse me. The
right.
government strategy is to seal off areas that the opposition rebels have taken and essentially to starve them out. They bombard them with artillery. Nobody gets in or out. And I think they do this because they don't have that number of combat troops. They have quite a lot of people who have been drafted into the army who can man a checkpoint. So they sort of surround these areas. And then finally there's some sort of deal, or that's what they hope. And in some cases that means that the opposition keep their weapons, that in some cases the release of prisoners. It all depends on the local balance of power. This is kind of new, and it's, you know, some of the opposition say it's a type of surrender, but actually, you know, at least in these areas, some people can go home, and people aren't getting killed, you know, so basically it's positive.
Mm. You know, it sort of seemed to me, from way over here in Texas, of course, that the Free Syrian Army itself is almost a mythological thing, or sound like a bunch of expats sitting on the Turkish side of the border while al-Nusra has been doing all the fighting all these years and whatever. And then, you know, if there are any group that's been called the moderates by the Western press that I can see, always end up to be cannibals or something worse, right? Turn around and start beheading people and declare their loyalty to Zarqawi over there in Pakistan, right? Like the Islamic Front. They said, oh, here are the new moderates, the Islamic Front. And then that guy declared, their leader declared loyalty to Zawahiri the next day, this kind of thing. What is the FSA? How many members does it have, if any?
Well, nobody really knows, you know, because there's said to be, I mean, U.S. intelligence at one point said there are 1,200 different rebel groups in Syria, and some would be a sort of, you know, small couple of families, and some would be thousands of men. So nobody quite knows, and nobody... You know, a lot of these units are probably getting money from abroad for, you know, let's say 5,000 men, but maybe they only have sort of 1,500. So, you know, you can pocket the remainder. So nobody quite knows. I think one important point to make is, which I think outsiders get wrong a lot, is to imagine, you know, that Jabhat al-Nusra is the official al-Qaeda affiliate. Then you have the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, which was associated with al-Qaeda, doesn't seem to be anymore, but actually the Islamic Front, all these jihadis are pretty well the same, you know. I mean, I was talking, a friend of mine was talking to various Syrian fighters on the Turkish side of the border, you know, having cups of tea with them, and the subject of 9/11 came up, you know, and my friend said, you know, the one thing you noticed about all these guys, they all thought 9/11 was a really good idea. You know, so these jihadis, you know, you read learned articles in different American or British papers about how these guys differ. But actually, when it comes, they might be different in their paymasters. When it comes to ideology, they're very much the same. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't know if... It's funny the way people... It's sort of been the red herring all along, although it's sort of part of it, but they always pretend that Islamic extremism is somehow... You know, the very deepest motivation going on here, rather than, you know, earthly politics and all that kind of thing. So they define, you know, these groups supposedly by the degree of their belief in Muhammad or something like that. But that's hardly the question when, for example, John McCain was posing with the Northern Storm Brigade, the same guys who were already on camera telling Time magazine reporters that, yeah, we're veterans of the Iraq War, where we went and fought the Americans, right? So who cares if they had the exact same religious beliefs as Zarqawi? If they're veterans, they're battle-hardened veterans of the war against the Americans in Iraq, and these are the guys that John McCain is palling around with.
Yeah, I think it's a general question. You know, I think it's McCain, but also, you make me think of Christopher Stevens, the American ambassador in Benghazi in Libya, who was sort of, clearly underestimated the kind of threat that you had from jihadis because these guys didn't have Osama bin Laden written on their hat. They weren't under operational control from somebody in Pakistan. But their actual ideology, they want an Islamic State, they want Sharia, they want a secondary status for women, they want really a return to the practices of the time 1,400 years ago when the Prophet Muhammad was alive. There isn't much difference, and I think it's a sort of been mistake of American, British, other policies to imagine that there's a great gap between these different jihadi groups. They all believe pretty well the same thing.
All right, now, we've talked before about how in the Western capitals, they thought this was going to be easy. Oh, Assad, step aside, and this kind of thing. And it turned out not to be so much. And it seemed from the outside, I'm just an amateur criminologist here, Patrick, but it sort of seemed like they've decided better than to really help these rebels win, whichever sect of rebels they are exactly. And that maybe if they don't want to outright switch back to Assad or to him, maybe they don't want to really help them win so much. But then, so my question is around the recent reports of Prince Bandar having the portfolio taken away from him, or however they say, where he's been called off the Syrian case by his overlords in Saudi Arabia, and that maybe their government has taken a different policy as well in terms of backing down in their attempted regime change in Syria. What do you think of that? Does that sound right?
Yeah, I think it is very important. And it's still not exactly clear what the new Saudi policy is going to be, but it's meant to be more against these jihadis and al-Qaeda-type organizations that the King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia has decreed that any Saudi who goes and fights in Syria would face 20 to 30 years in jail when they get home, other restraints on people going to Syria. But it's not quite clear if that's really happening, because there isn't much restraint on Saudi preachers and appearing on satellite TV. I mean, people who have millions of followers still seem to be encouraging people to go to Syria to fight in jihad. So, it's difficult to know what's sure. Prince Bandar has been marginalized, and that looks pretty significant because he was leading the pack on getting rid of Assad and supporting al-Qaeda-type organizations or jihadi organizations.
Right.
And that's changed.
Okay, we'll have to stop right here and take a quick break. We'll be right back with more from Patrick Coburn from The Independent. That's independent.co.uk as well as counterpunch.org. Just a sec. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. All right. Sorry. I like this. All right, I'm Scott. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Thanks, everybody, for listening. I'm talking with Patrick Coburn about the crisis in Syria, the permanent crisis there, quite a few years old now. And there's so many different directions to go here. I guess as long as we're talking, Patrick, about Saudi influence in this botched half-regime change effort here in Syria, let me ask you about the context, I guess, then for Maliki's accusations against Saudi Arabia, claiming that they're backing the Sunni-based insurgency there in Iraq, too. And I have a feeling that you're going to say, yeah, exactly, that's what we're talking about here, has been going on. But then my real question would be going back in the days of the Iraq War, when the prime enemy of the American occupation there, when the prime enemy of the Sunni-based insurgency was the Americans, was the Sunni, the Saudi royal family backing the Sunni insurgency back that whole time, too?
Yeah, I think they probably supported it. You know, it's sort of, the royal family itself doesn't have to do much. It just has to allow private donors to and supporters to do their thing. And, you go to the 9/11 commission report, it says, the main support for al-Qaeda was private donors in Saudi Arabia and to a lesser extent the Gulf, About 8 years later, Hillary Clinton was sending a cable, which WikiLeaks revealed, saying Saudi Arabia is the main financier for jihadi movements. I think she says terrorist movements in throughout the world, whether it's in Pakistan or Iraq or anywhere else. Now it's shifted a bit more to Kuwait, but it's really the Gulf monarchies. I mean, there's always, when you come to Syria and Saudi Arabia, it's always, I think, absurd to imagine that Saudi Arabia, which is one of the only other Gulf monarchies, which are the last sort of absolutist theocratic monarchies in the world, would be interested in spreading secular democracy to Syria or Iraq or anywhere else. There's always a contradiction there.
Sure. I'm sorry, just to clarify one point there about Hillary Clinton and that document. They weren't referring to Saudi Arabia as a place where, money comes out of that country. She was referring to Saudi Arabia, the state apparatus itself, the princes, the people in charge, that they were deliberately, as a matter of policy, funding these groups, correct?
No, not quite. No, it's more just donations, Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be a government check. All they have to do is not try to prevent donations being made. Money is difficult to prevent money being transferred anyway. I think she was referring primarily to private donations, which of course might come from princes and so forth. Mm-hmm. But I doubt if it could actually come out of the Saudi finance ministry, because that would be too obvious.
Yeah, but with their connivance, in other words, though, this can't be going on.
Sure, yeah, generally. I mean, there are different ways of doing this.
Right.
But they were doing that. I think there's another point, Scott, that people don't quite take on board, is that, the Iraq-Syrian border doesn't really exist anymore.
Right.
Now, when Saudi Arabia, the Gulf, the United States, Turkey, when they support rebels in Syria, then that support also goes to rebels in Iraq. The Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, which means Greater Syria, covers both countries. There's been a big surge in Iraq of suicide bombers over the last year. It's pretty well been one a day at the moment. And where do these bombers come from? Well, they're coming into Syria. A lot of these foreigners think they're going to be fighting in Syria, but they end up in Baghdad, driving a truck full of explosives into the local Shia marketplace. So this war, is now in both countries. So when the U.S. and the others support the rebels in Syria, they're also destabilizing the Iraqi government and giving, basically ensuring that the support for the rebels in Iraq. But somehow that hasn't sort of, that message, although it's pretty obvious, and it's sort of admitted by administration officials in sort of small meetings, it hasn't, I think, got across to the general public yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've even seen where in, one news story about one interaction between State Department flunkies and the Maliki government, they on one hand pledge more support for his fight against the Sunni insurgents in Iraq at the very same meeting. They're chastising him for helping Iran ship weapons and personnel and material and whatever to Assad for the very same fight.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of, you know, when the U.S. and the others decided to back the rebels militarily in Syria, at that instant, you know, they destabilized Iraq. They sent, and they don't seem to have realized what they were doing. But it seems to me one of the great sort of one of the many blunders of U.S. administrations in Iraq and Syria, but one that people haven't really picked up on yet.
Right. Well, and now speaking of which, as far as the Iraq crisis goes, let's see, they have parliamentary elections coming up at some point here soon, right?
Yeah, it's in April, but you know, things are deteriorating. You know, there were 8,500 civilians killed last year. There's a, there's a suicide bombing attack every day.
I wonder whether you think the Sunnis will even participate in the elections, or they're just completely frozen out of the system now.
Well, increasingly, you're dead right. I mean, if you take Anbar province, which is an enormous province, which contains Fallujah and Ramadi, you know, Fallujah is held by Al-Qaeda at the moment. They hold a lot of the rest of the province. Now, the population of Anbar, is where most of the fighting with the U.S. was, is about 1.6 million, and about 500,000 have fled because of the government is shelling the towns and villages. So, you know, taking part in an election is not exactly the first thing on these people's minds. They're trying to stay alive and get enough to eat.
Right, not that winning would do them any good anyway, right? I mean, why bother?
Yeah, I mean, it's basically, you know, they're marginalized. And I think, you know, there was a protest movement from the end of 2012, that sort of Iraqi Arab Spring, and they had lots of demonstrations, but they sort of decided it wasn't getting them anywhere. One peace camp at a place called Hawija was attacked by the army and about 50 people killed. So, you know, what we're seeing at the moment is sort of peaceful opposition and demonstrations sort of mutating into armed opposition, and that effectively means support for Al-Qaeda.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, as I know you know, the nation-state was only invented in the 1600-somethings. I mean, there have been sort of kind of nations in the past, but this particular system for the Middle East is really just a stamp, right? A thing placed upon them by the former European imperial powers. And I wonder whether you think that the state system, you know, when we're talking about, for example, the border between Syria and Iraq ceasing to exist, how many more of these borders are going to cease to exist as the states in the region just seem to crumble and as the right-wing forces of reaction and primarily along ethnic lines seem to be taking predominance in people's minds over there?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's no doubt that the nation states are getting weaker, you know. There's no doubt in my mind also, you know, this is a bad thing. You know, if you have a nation state and people within the state, you know, have a degree of common loyalty to each other, that they accept the results of elections without slitting each other's throats. But if you don't have a loyalty, some form of national loyalty, you know, what loyalty will people look to? Well, it'll be tribal, it'll be ethnic, it'll be religious. And that means that these places, you know, become involved in a sort of multi-layered civil war.
Right, I mean, well, for this one, the original sin here is the invasion of Iraq in 2003. Not that, you know, World War I wasn't also full of consequences for the region and this kind of thing, but it seems like if we could only take back that Iraq invasion, so much of this would not be a problem right now. And that's not a call for supporting dictatorships, but certainly we don't want to be the ones supporting Al-Qaeda and overthrowing them either.
No, you know, and also, you know, look at Libya, you know, which is being presented by Obama and Cameron, Britain, Sarkozy, and France, you know, as the exemplar of successful foreign intervention. You know, they were grandstanding in Benghazi and Tripoli. Well, they sure aren't doing that now, because they'd be dead if they tried. You know, the Prime Minister of Libya fled this this week. An oil tanker has picked up crude oil from the east of the country. The government said they'd stop it, they'd sink it, they weren't able to. So the country's breaking up. There's fighting all over. This is kind of an example of how all these interventions, really over the last 10 years, have invariably gone sour and generally produced a worse result for the people of Libya and Syria and Iraq than what they had before. You could argue.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your time, as always. It's great to talk to you, Patrick.
Okay. All right. Bye-bye.
All right, everybody, that is the great Patrick Coburn, the heroic Patrick Coburn, at The Independent. That's independent.co.uk. You can also find him at counterpunch.org and at unz.com. That's UNZ, unz.com. And we'll be right back after this with Scott McConnell. On March 7th at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., the Council for the National Interest is co-hosting the first-ever national summit to reassess the U.S.-Israel special relationship. Confirmed speakers include Walt Scheuer, Giraldi, McGovern, Katowski, Porter, McConnell, Weiss, Raimondo, USS Liberty survivor Ernie Gallo, as well as co-sponsors Alison Ware of If Americans Knew and the great Grant Smith of the Institute for Research, Middle East Policy. That's the national summit to reassess the U.S.-Israel special relationship, Friday, March the 7th, all day at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., natsummit.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. Thank God dang news is finally over. And now the show's back on. All right, well, I'm Scott Horton, this is my show. ScottHorton.org is my website. And my next guest is Scott McConnell. He's a co-founding editor of the American Conservative magazine. Available for subscription and on your newsstand. And online at theamericanconservative.com. Welcome back to the show, Scott. How are you doing?
I'm doing good, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing good. Did I say Scott McConnell? Or I gave you a whole preface, but I never did say your name. Scott McConnell, everybody. Welcome back. So your last three pieces here are really good stuff on Ukraine. So I'll be very happy to hear what you think about it out loud, I'm pretty sure. Starting with the fact that the American people... starting with the last thing you've written about here, the fact that the American people are pretty good on the Ukraine issue from a peace and liberty point of view, huh?
I have to admit that's a very pleasant surprise to me, because for the last 3 weeks there's been a media and politician, Washington politician, drumbeat about Obama being weak and feckless and Russia's attempt to essentially move against the new Ukraine government as being this huge threat to world peace, and it really didn't seem to me at all. But I thought when you have like that, generally people follow the lead of what the Washington elites are saying, and in this case, not at all. I.e., there was a recent Pew Research poll that said, should the United States not care very much about Ukraine, or should we consider a range of responses from severe sanctions to military options. And the answer of this isn't really a big deal for us was by kind of 2-to-1 margins, 55% to 25%, or among independents it was, 62% to 25%. I mean, really fairly decisive margins. So it was a kind of... surprising disjuncture between what the people were saying in response to a straightforward poll question and what the range of Washington politicians from, Hillary Clinton to John McCain was saying. So I thought that was an encouraging sign, but still the Ukraine situation is dangerous because we might do more than we need to.
Yeah, I think the way you write it here, you seem to be saying that the American people might have had the same attitude toward the Soviet Union even. Except for the argument that the politicians made back in the Cold War was that, hey, we're not just talking about a big Russian empire here. We're talking about ideological communism hell-bent on conquering the planet Earth. We must resist. And under those circumstances, they were willing to have a Cold War. Fine, let's contain them then, the Americans said. But without that, what do we care about what's going on in some country we can't pronounce, you know?
It's true. I mean, I personally think that the Cold War was a big deal. I mean, I supported containment. You didn't have to fight. Like, fighting in Vietnam was not good. But I generally, looking back, am supportive of the measures we did in Europe from 47 onwards. And I think that there were, you know, large issues at stake. But I think everybody kind of intuitively understands spheres of influence, and that Ukraine is historically very close to Russia. It's not, you know, France and Italy. It's not Germany. It's not Hungary. It's right there. There are a very important, you know, religious links between Ukraine and Russia, and it's right there on the doorstep. So, what do the Russians think when we have one of the top neoconservatives in the State Department is essentially in Kiev a month ago, basically picking who the ministers would be of a new government in Ukraine. I mean, I can't imagine that they would look at that as like benignly, and they haven't.
Right. In fact, here's that clip real quick, or a piece of it.
Economic experience, the governing experience. I think Yats is the guy who's got the economic experience, the governing experience. He's the guy, you know, what he needs is Cleach and Tawny Brook on the outside. He needs to be talking to them four times a week, you know.
Anyway, so that's the tone of the thing, is Victoria Nuland, the Assistant Secretary of State for Europe, which is, I gather that's basically the ambassador to the European Union, Scott, is that about right?
Oh, she's the the guy he's talking to is the ambassador to Ukraine, and she's the Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs, which is probably the top official dealing with Europe in the Obama State Department. And from what I saw, you know, Kerry and Obama were pretty much engaged with other things, so she would have a lot of leeway in forging European policy.
Mm-hmm. And they're talking about Ukraine like they own it. Well, we're going to do this. You know, I don't like this one guy. I would rather have the other guy. The guy who, by the way, was just meeting with Obama in the Oval Office yesterday, the new prime minister, Yats.
Yeah.
Her pick.
It's the first time I've heard the tape, actually. It's good that you have it.
Oh, really? Oh, I'll send you all the clips. I won't waste your interview playing them, but I'll send them to you.
Victoria Nuland is the wife of Robert Kagan, who is one of the most important neoconservative foreign policy writers. He co-writes a lot of things with Bill Kristol, and he's one of the sort of ideological engineers of the Iraq War, among other things, but of a generally very assertive, aggressive American foreign policy to begin with. And I assume that Victoria Nuland and Kagan see these things eye to eye, and they, you know, they basically think the Europeans are a bunch of wimps because they care about, you know, economics and vacation more than they care about power politics. And so here she is, I mean, right really on Russia's doorstep, you know, trying to organize a revolutionary anti-Russian government. And it's extraordinary to me that Obama could let that happen, or that Kerry could let that happen, because I tend to have a think that Obama and Kerry are a little wiser than that, but they did, you know, and here we are.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you call this in one of your articles here, this entirely self-inflicted Ukraine disaster. I talked with one writer who thought that maybe their offer to Yanukovych was deliberately so bad that he would have to turn it down and tilt back toward Russia, all the easier to foment a coup. They would rather have a deal with the next guy than a deal with the guy they didn't like. That kind of possibility. And yet all they really succeeded in doing was, I mean, even for the time being, they control the government in Kiev, or their friends do, but it looks like they're going to lose Crimea, which is what they're after in the first place, right? Or somewhere.
Yeah, I honestly don't know what's going to happen. I think it's tricky for Russia to take Crimea because it isn't really linked by land. So if you want to like trade with Crimea, or you want to supply it with gas and stuff, you have to go through the eastern Ukraine, and I'm actually worried about what might happen. I mean, we've made it into, rather than sort of our policy should be, Ukraine should be a kind of neutral place between the West and Russia, and we understand that Russia cares, like, a lot about what goes on there. Our policy had been, let's take Ukraine away from Russia, move it to the West, and make it part of our alliance structure. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, it's not easy to divide the country up. I mean, I don't really have answers, but it's not going to be like Russia's going to be able to just take Crimea, I don't think. I think that's geographically a little difficult because Crimea is not connected to Russia except through, well, like, these straits and stuff. Mm-hmm.
Well, although in the east, it's just, isn't there a bridge there? Or it's just a very small hop.
Know,
they could build a bridge pretty easily.
They could build a bridge, but, you know, a bridge is not, I mean, they can build a bridge.
Right.
But,
I mean, it's closer than the Florida Keys are to Florida, and they got a bridge there.
Yeah.
Like the Saudis rolling tanks into Bahrain, right?
Yeah. No, I mean, Russia can certainly militarily control Crimea, but the eastern Ukraine, which is, I think, somewhat more Russian-oriented, certainly more Russian-oriented than the western Ukraine, is in play. There's now, like, you know, headlines in the Times, at least this afternoon, about a lot of Russian troop activity on the borders of eastern Ukraine. I don't know, true, not true, how true, what it means. I don't think that this, I mean, it seems to be gearing up into, like, a major crisis.
Yeah.
It would probably be not a good thing to have a major crisis about. It's certainly an area infinitely more important to Russia than to us. And I think we have a real national interest in having, like, calm relations with Russia. I mean, there's, that's...
Well, yeah, I mean, to have a border dispute this far from our border seems a little strange to me. But, yeah, I want to talk with you about some of the interests that we have with the Russians and just how important in the scheme of things those interests might be compared to who rules in Kiev. More with Scott McConnell from the American Conservative Magazine when we get back from this break. Just a minute, y'all. Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Scott McConnell. He's got a great first name and a great little magazine over there, the American Conservative Magazine, home of the anti-war right, theamericanconservative.com. And we're talking about this disaster, this building disaster in Ukraine. As Scott was saying right before the break, reports are that the Russians are mobilizing troops near the eastern border of Ukraine, and I guess that would be the next move on the chessboard if Putin wants to make it, would be seizing East Ukraine, and I guess Obama would have to take it. But what if they took the whole country? Wouldn't he have to do something about that, quote unquote, according to power politics in Washington, D.C.?
Well, there's not, I don't think you would have an intentional war about that. And I actually don't think that would happen. But even, you know, troops in the eastern Ukraine is likely to get everybody very tense for a long time.
Right.
I don't want to be overly alarmist. I'm just, like, reading the headlines in the New York Times on the web. I don't have
I don't like being alarmist either. I mean, it seems to me like Putin's already winning in every way. Last time we did a coup there in 2004, all he had to do was wait around a couple of years, and then he got this guy in. And now we've couped him again, Yanukovych, but... You know, he'll have another, especially like if you're saying maybe he doesn't run off with Crimea, then he'll have another chance at the ballot box in a little while, assuming they keep holding elections over there.
Yeah.
I mean, why blow it? Why go so far as to even have any level of war, proxy or otherwise, over there?
I think it's hard for the Ukrainians. I mean, it's a very divided country, and I think it's hard for them to have... elections where they, you know, even remotely agree on much common ground between I mean, I've known just Western Ukrainians like who are completely disdainful of the Russian Ukrainians. Anyway. Mm.
Yeah, it's almost the Sunnis in Iraq call the Shiites the Iranians, even though they're not the Iraqis, but they're the Iranians.
No, I guess Putin, he's quoted as once telling George W. Bush, you know it's not a real country. And I don't, I mean, and Bush, I mean, who knows? I don't know what a real country is, but I think that the Russians don't think of Ukraine as a real country, probably.
Yeah. Well, so I don't know. Talk a little bit more about, and you've written about this at the American Conservative too, Scott, about, well, what interests do we have at stake? What makes it so important that we get along with the Russians, other than the fact that they have H-bombs? In other words, you know, when it comes to picking on somebody our own size, they are. And so we better be careful about that in, you know, in the worst case scenario sense. But what about everything else we got to work with them on?
Well, first, Afghanistan. We have troops in Afghanistan. We're going to have them there. They're going to come out, I think, fairly soon. But they are at least, I think, a lot of their resupplying, and I actually don't know the percentage, comes through a Russian base in Ulanovsk or somewhere like that. Somebody can correct my Russians, but it's Lenin's birthplace, actually. But that's, you know, the main non-Pakistani supply conduit. So to get stuff in and out to the remaining American troops there. So, you know, if we decide to get really, really tough with Russia over, Crimea, then, you know, maybe that base won't be supplying them. Now, I guess the American troops could get out through Pakistan, but that might be, I can imagine that would be costly in lives and certainly more expensive, but perhaps bloodier. And I'm sure that the American commanders of the American troops in Afghanistan do not want to see their access to resupply through the Russian route cut off. Secondly, there's dreadful things going on in Syria. It's not, I don't know, you know, it's difficult to say whose fault it is, but I think there's a common human interest in seeing the extent that great powers can cooperate to stop a civil war. It requires Russia and America being kind of on the same page, rather than thinking, you know, it's a, when, you know, whatever, you know, is good for me is bad for you, and vice versa. Which, I mean, so, but if you make a Cold War situation out of it, it's going to be a humanitarian disaster for Syria. Thirdly, Iran. It's kind of interesting. I think Russia and America both are on the same page with Iran. There are probably people who welcome like a kind of a more of a Cold War attitude between Russia and the United States over Iran, because it might make the United States more hawkish or more supportive of Israeli military action or things like this. I'm being pretty speculative here, but I think Russia and America have a joint interest in, or had a joint interest in, bringing Iran, you know, back into the family of nations and kind of regulating and supervising or overseeing its nuclear program and not ending it. And so that ends, and Russia and America are at odds over Ukraine or something like that, then, it makes war more likely in the Middle East. Those are 3 points I would make. And just generally speaking, I think, Russia is a big, great power, and I don't think there's any innate hostility between the American people and the Russian people, nor do we have huge conflicts of interest that are obvious. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it seems like if you run a hawkish think tank, then okay, yeah, it makes great sense to, you know, try to relive your Cold Warrior days and all that. But if Pat Buchanan can put in writing and come on this show and talk about how, oh, Russia, yeah, well, you see, Russia is not the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union is dead and gone, and their military, the Red Army, does not exist, and they do not occupy the you know, dozen nations on their periphery that they used to occupy, and those days are gone. We do not have to have this kind of conflict. If that's good enough for Pat, that ought to be good enough for anybody on the right or left or anywhere on the political spectrum in America, right?
Pat is absolutely right about that. But there, there's a lot of Cold War nostalgia for, or, you know, I think people in Washington often need to feel important and need to feel that they're, you know, engaged in a big, you know, earth-shattering, world-important conflict to justify, you know, whatever, you know, their decision-making, their getting up in the morning. And so there are a lot of people in Washington, not just Republicans, who welcome, like, at least a low-level Cold War with Russia. And the idea of just thinking Russia's a great power on the other side of the globe, which with whom we have no major conflict of interest, is anathema to them.
All right, now, we're real short on time. I guess I want to ask you about Robert Perry's theory that, you know, when he talked about all those interests, Ukraine, other than... that Ukraine is messing up, but especially Iran and Syria and our cooperation with Russia being important on those issues. Robert Perry over at Consortium News seems to think that this is, you know, amounts to some insubordination by the likes of Victoria Nuland and some of the neocons, and that they are doing this particularly in order to drive a wedge between America and Russia while we are in the middle of negotiating on Iran and Syria, these two very important issues for them. And they're getting revenge on Putin for making the chemical weapons deal that prevented the civil entry, the American direct intervention into the war in Syria last summer. And they're trying to screw up the Iran nuclear deal, which is yet to be finalized.
Yep.
What do you think of that?
Yes, I think that's plausible. And I'm not, I hadn't heard that theory before, but I think it makes a fair amount of sense, and I'd like to read and think more about it. I mean, certainly, you know, Victoria Nuland doesn't operate in a vacuum. She's part of a, you know, kind of large neoconservative policy network where they kind of, you know, think and act a lot and coordinate in certain ways. And insubordination, you know, she should not have been, you know, allowed to have been in the square in Maidan Square in Kiev, you know, choosing ministers.
And that's my word,
really,
by the way, you know, summarizing Perry. I don't believe he used that term exactly,
yeah.
So I should be careful about
that. Yeah. No, I think that's an interesting theory, and it's a line of speculation that we should be hearing more about depending on what happens in the weeks to come.
And then real quickly here, I guess we have about a minute and a half. Can you talk about the difference of opinion between the Europeans and the Americans about how to proceed from here? I think you write that the Germans and the British apparently are much less enthusiastic about ramping up this conflict and adding new sanctions, et cetera.
I mean, so far, when you talk about sanctions, you talk about, you know, they are, I mean, Britain has major, like all the Russian oligarchs, or a lot of them have decamped to London and bought a lot of properties
right.
And are very involved with the financial system. And Germany gets a very, very large percentage of its energy needs in terms of Russian natural gas. So they are definitely not eager for, you know, let's have a new Cold War. It would come at financial cost to them and not necessarily to us.
Right. Yeah, they can steal more over the long term if they let these guys stay. I get it.
Yeah. But I don't think they're comfortable. I mean, I think they definitely wish that this hadn't happened, you know, starting from, you know, when. And they are in part responsible for the overreach of trying to, you know, bring Ukraine into the EU. I mean, that's their somewhat assertive step. And I haven't actually seen some analysis whether they think that, you know, whether Angela Merkel, who should understand Putin pretty well, they come from similar backgrounds, thinks that, you know, maybe, you know, they shouldn't be, like, trying to woo Ukraine away from the Russian orbit. Anyway.
Right, we'll have to stop there. Thanks so much for your time. I sure appreciate it, Scott.
Thank you, Scott.
All right, that's Scott McConnell from the American Conservative magazine. He co-founded it, theamericanconservative.com, on Ukraine. Cool the triumphalism. our entirely self-inflicted Ukraine disaster, and push for a new Cold War seems to stall. Thank goodness. Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the Dang Old Show here. I'm Scott. This is my show. In case you missed it, the latest two Snowden pieces, I think they're the latest two, at The Intercept, how the NSA plans to infect millions of computers with malware. Not so sure about the future tense of that headline. Sounds like it's operational now, but they just don't know exactly how operational. But, yeah. There was a follow-up at CNET, I think, or somebody. Who was it? Ars Technica? No, that was something else. Technica? Let's see. There was a follow-up saying that what the NSA is doing is hijacking everybody else's botnet. You know, the botnet attack where they enslave your computer and turn it into a spamming machine? Or whatever the hell they do with it. Turn it into an attack machine against somebody else. Well, every time that happens, or I don't know, when that happens, the NSA can hijack the process and get their own dirty work done at the same time. Thanks for your help. If you're one of those technical guys who understands what all this stuff means, then you'll have a ball reading this thing. It's really hard on my eyes because I don't really get it all that well. I try very hard to glean the meaning, but I'm just not a computer guy, man. I wish I was, but no. Anyway, the one I understood better and appreciated the horror of more fully, I think, was the Charlie Savage, Laura Poitras piece in the New York Times. How a court, that is the FISA court, Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act court, how a court secretly evolved, extending U.S. spies' reach. And of course the answer is, they took language from the law, and they held it down and raped it, and they made it say what they wanted it to say. They tortured it with, you know, water and confined spaces, stress positions, and temperature manipulation, electrocution, slaps to the face. You know, typical CIA stuff. You know, they drowned the law to death over and over again, bringing it back to life at the last second. Until the law agreed to say whatever they wanted it to say. And now it says that they can do whatever they want. Well, you know, I don't know. I'm making this crap up on the fly. So are they. So, as funny as I am is as credible as their legal opinions are. How about that? All right, well. So that's Savage and Poitras at the Times, and Gallagher and Greenwald at the Intercept. It's sitting over by a long shot. And now let me say something else. People all the time attacking Glenn Greenwald. Well, he made a deal with a billionaire. You know what? You make a deal with a billionaire, you open yourself up to attack. That's fine. I don't think it's wrong for people to attack him. I think that's great for people to attack him. I'm pretty sure he doesn't really care either. But my attitude is, I want to defend the guy to you, in case you're really worried about Glenn Greenwald. I know the guy, not that well, but I've interviewed him a bunch of times. Although I admit it's getting hard to get him on the show these days. But I've interviewed him a ton of times, and I've read 10 million words he's ever written before, especially back when he was at Salon.com. I've been reading him since 2005, and look, I can just tell you, okay? If I'm wrong, then I guess, you know, I'm a real jerk. But look, if Glenn Greenwald thought that the billionaire guy that he made the deal with to build this Intercept news thing of his, if he thought that that guy was pressuring him, or he felt pressure by that billionaire to write about a subject or to not write about a subject or to write in a certain way about a subject or to not hire that guy because of the way he writes about a subject or anything like that, I guarantee you, take my word for it, okay? Glenn Greenwald would quit that day with no notice you would just see unclaimed territory back up, or his whatever, his side blog where he posts his documents. And he would say, announcing my departure from my partnership with this jerk. And it would be over like that. And I guess, you know, the saying is everybody's got a price and this, that, and the other thing. But you know what? I don't think so about Glenn Greenwald. I think that he would put... I think it's beyond question that Glenn Greenwald puts a higher value on his own honesty than on any amount of money. And after all, how much money is he going to pay Greenwald? Millions and millions? And then tell him, but don't write about this or that. You know, in Greenwald's latest response to the latest attacks, he said he never found out anything about the family that owned Salon.com. Virtually nothing, he said. Hell, I didn't even know it was a family owned Salon.com. There you go. And he said he didn't care because it didn't have anything to do with his job. All he had to do was do his work. And that was the deal he made with them in the first place, is I hit publish on my own damn blog and you don't get to tell me otherwise unless the most extreme circumstances, you know, where you're accusing me of knowingly, you know, lying about some innocent person, whatever, you know, something extreme. Otherwise, butt out completely in my writing, other than admiring it. Thank you. That was his deal with Salon, so it didn't matter who they were or what their other investments were. Now, this guy Omidyar, according to the Marcy Wheeler version, which sounds like it's probably the truth to me, is he gave money to a group that gave money to a group that's helping with this promote democracy crap in Ukraine. Part of the astroturfing democracy movements, again, you know, that they do the same scheme over and over again against all the governments they don't like in the world and want a regime change. And now, to the degree that that means Omidyar is a conspirator with Uncle Sam and Victoria Nuland and whatever over there regime changing, it raises the possibility, but it doesn't even really imply that he's aware of how this works at all. I mean, on the face of it, we just like promoting democracy and reform and transparency and this kind of crap. And that's the kind of thing where if you're a billionaire, you give money to all kinds of groups. In fact, I think the way Marcy wrote it was that he gave money to this group that then gives money to other groups. And they have those too. This has gotten people falsely associated with the Koch brothers before, because they got some scholarship from some group that got money from a group that the Kochs had given money to that was then dispersing it to whoever. Not that they even controlled it. It was just one thing that they had donated to. So these kinds of things are complicated. It could be that Omidyar is up to his eyeballs in regime changes. And if he really is up to his eyeballs in regime changes, then I think Glenn Greenwald ought to write about that. And in fact, I think he would write about that if there was really a story there. I don't think he would have a problem writing with that. And if it became a real problem, I think he would leave his arrangement. He would quit his contract with this guy rather than be dishonest. And I'm just saying that because, you know, that's what I think of the guy. I've read a million words he wrote. I've interviewed him 100 times. I think he's a good egg. And I think these people who are saying, well, yeah, but Glenn Greenwald doesn't agree with me about everything. You have a great point about that, but that does not mean that he's corrupt. Does not mean that he's dishonest with you. And in fact, the biggest criticism of him that I've heard is that, why don't you just release all the documents? The people have a right to know and all of that. And he said before, in I'm not exactly certain which terms, but he said before that he would kind of like to. Something like that. But he's got a deal with Ed Snowden. And his deal with Ed Snowden from the very beginning was, hey, listen, you got to report these documents carefully and well. Not just release them out there. Because then everyone's going to call me a bad guy trying to hurt my country or whatever. I don't want that. I want responsible journalists telling the people what they got to know. And if there's anything else in there, you know, it can be for your own edification as a journalist and your own further understanding, but don't release it. And now, I don't necessarily like those terms. I would prefer to see it all just posted up on WikiLeaks myself. Go ahead and post it up there, though the heavens fall and whatever the hell. I don't care if there's names of spies in there, really. I don't know what Greenwald's position on that is. I think he doesn't want to be accused, or I'm sure he doesn't want to, you know, compromise actual people and get them in trouble, right? If there's a document that says we have a group of spies in, you know, X country planting sensors at these locations, he doesn't want to get them rolled up or hurt or whatever. That's just an example I made up. It's not in his interest to do that in the first place. But also, he made a deal with Ed Snowden that in exchange for the documents, he would promise to report them and to work with other journalists to get them reported, and that he would not go ahead and post them all online. So, you know, those are the breaks. It hardly makes this some kind of limited hangout. It hardly makes Greenwald the bad guy. And I mean, just look at the stories they've broken over the last year. And, you know, in a way, I kind of think the deluge would be really good for the big war of public opinion. But then again, you know, the Snowden water torture against the national security state, if anybody deserves it, it's them. And they never know what's coming out next, so all their denials are all half-assed and quite campy a lot of the times because they don't know whether Glenn Greenwald is going to smack them down with the next set of documents coming out the next week. And, you know, the New York Times and the Washington Post have copies, ProPublica have copies, the Guardian has some copies of some amount. I guess it's Greenwald and Poitras are the only ones with all of them. But there are a lot of newspapers operating on these same guidelines, just publishing what they can as soon as they can. And it's just coming out all over the place. And I think people are really learning, you know, you thought it blew over and then they go, yeah, no, they're tracking your cell phone location and saving it all forever. You know, you think it's all over and they go, yeah, they're using fake Facebook pages to install malware on your computer when you think you're logging into Facebook. Or you think it's all over, and then you realize, oh, no, they've hacked the foreign server, cloud servers of Yahoo and Google and have everything, all the search terms, all the URLs, all the Gmails, all of that. Oh, it's all foreign and legal under this, that, or the other loophole. You thought it was all over, and this stuff keeps coming out about how they're violating your rights. And so I think the American people are going to get better and better on this. And I'm actually pretty hopeful that the, I forgot, USA Freedom Act or whatever the hell they're calling it, that's going to roll back quite a bit of this stuff. I think ultimately it will pass. I don't think we'll have the Dianne Feinstein, you know, red herring bill. I think we'll get the Sensenbrenner bill that abolishes mass collection, at least under Section 215 of the Patriot Act. I don't know how much further it goes than that, but I think this is the year that we really are going to see some pushback, thanks to Ed Snowden and to Glenn Greenwald especially. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager who provides his subscribers with a very real window into his investments, updating them on every move he makes in the markets. Right now, Mike's anticipating a bear and is dumping all the stocks while the getting is good, investing instead in gold and the commodities. Protect your assets and learn the wise ways of the markets. WallStreetWindow.com. And check out Mike Swanson's great contribution to the history of the rise of the American Empire and the war state. Available at ScottHorton.org/Amazon. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And now we got to talk about the cops, man. First of all, let's talk about some good news, okay? Eric Holder, the Attorney General, moves against mandatory minimum drug sentencing, says the Newsweek headline. That's not quite right. He wants to loosen the guidelines so that people who are now doing, I just read it last night, is people doing 60-something months will only have to do 50-something months for this, for a medium amount. I guess they say the high volume convicts and the low volume convicts, their sentences stay the same, but people who have some drugs, middle quantities of drugs, they will have their mandatory minimum sentence guidelines reduced, is it. Who was the great lawyer, civil liberties lawyer guest on the show who explained how, you see what you're doing here? You've outsourced the sentencing to the prosecutors. It's up to the prosecutors to decide what kind of mandatory sentence they're going to seek. Then they seek, then they put the charge, they come up with the charge to fit the sentence they want. And then when they get their conviction, the judge has no say in the sentencing. The entire thing is completely corrupt. Mandatory minimum sentences. Like, you know who's never hard enough on the convicts? Judges. Really? That's an argument? I mean, okay, I know you saw Dirty Harry and everything, but do you think that's really true? I don't know. This is a pretty convincing movie, Scott. Anyway, so the mandatory minimum sentences are less worse than before. Three cheers for that. Then there's Lucy Steigerwald, I guess. She's a new contributing writer at antiwar.com, and this one is called The Blurred Line Between Cops and Soldiers. And within the first sentence, I learned that there are two congressmen who are trying to pass a new law that would limit the Pentagon's 1033 program. I really should have symbols and loud rounds of applause and insane, wild cheering type sound effects for this show. The 1033 program is one of the programs under which the military transfers all their surplus, whatever they want, to local and state police departments across the country. And so in practice, that means, MRAPs and armored personnel carriers and M16s and M4s and AR-15 rifles. It means military training and military gear. It means the turning, like just like in Cheney's grim vision, the turning of America into a literal battlefield. I mean, come on. You give these cops a budget for all of this stuff, and then you try to tell them that, yeah, but sir, you're altering the character of our entire society in a negative way. Wouldn't you rather not carry machine guns and drive around in armored personnel carriers and turn our society into the kind of place where the cops have machine guns and armored personnel carriers? And he will say, huh? I'm a cop with a budget, and I'm getting as many machine guns and as many armored personnel carriers as I possibly can. And you know how many cop exceptions there are to that rule in this society? None. You give them an inch, they will take 10 miles. They will spin out of control as far as they can, like a 4-year-old geeking out on sugar. They must be reined in. And then, are you kidding me? Seriously, congressmen in the USA, federal, national, general government, Washington, D.C. Congress here have introduced legislation to knock this off. To stop militarizing XYZ County in America. No, the people here, we're the people here. We're the civilians here. There are no enemy combatants among us. At worst, we are innocent suspects. Presumed innocent till proven beyond a reasonable doubt to be guilty in front of a jury later, man. At worst, our role as compared to a cop in our society is suspect, right? Even if he catches you eating some grandmother with the blood dripping from your fangs, you're still just a suspect until they prove that nobody framed you up that way or whatever it is that's got to be proved to get past the jury. Why in the world should we have to tolerate SWAT teams, paramilitary, no-knock raids, Waco-style raids, hundreds of times a day in this society, cops dressed up like stormtroopers of death, like they just got back from doing night raids in Afghanistan and doing the very same things to us. Just like, you know, in a Chalmers Johnson prophecy or something. Oh my God, there's a congressman, there are two congressmen who are introducing a bill to repeal the authority for the Pentagon to give this stuff away to the cops. Representative Hank Johnson, Democrat, Georgia, and Michael Schenck. Oh, no, he's not a congressman. He's from the Friends Committee. I love those guys, man, the Quakers. Representative Hank Johnson. I don't know anything else about him, but this is the greatest thing to happen in Congress in a long, long time here. Since Ron Paul roamed the halls. This is beautiful. This is so important. Whatever group you're part of, if you're part of a group, see what you can do to help publicize this. What can we do, right? Get Come Home America, get the ACLU and the CCR and all of the left-wing civil liberties groups, the lawyers groups on board for this, get all the families against mandatory sentencing and all the, get everybody's damn group on board for this. Do you have a group? Are you part of a group of any kind, a political group of any kind? The Wednesday Night Bowling League against the militarization of America. We need you to support this thing. This is huge. And even if it doesn't pass this time, this is huge. We have to force a debate about this, a fight about this. You know, this is like support for Israel. Oh, you can't talk about that for some reason. No, we can too. We have to break through that. We have to make this a part of the official news cycle. The official narrative from the TV about what's important in our society today. We can't, they don't always get to choose. We can make them cover this. We can make this an issue. Representative Johnson wants to reform, at least, the Pentagon's 1033 program. I don't know the name of the bill. I guess I don't have the name of the bill in here. But check this out. It's written up at USA Today, and you can find the link in Lucy Steigerwald's column today at antiwar.com as well. The USA Today column is called Small Town America Shouldn't Resemble a War Zone by Hank Johnson and Michael Schenck. And, you know, I'm not the biggest champion of electoral politics and participating in democracy in that way and whatever. But you know what, man? I really don't want to live in a militarized national police state, do you? Aren't we already sliding so far down this path? I don't think it's contributing much legitimacy to the state to participate in it to the extent of supporting a bill like this and opposing a policy like the one that's prevailed so far in militarizing virtually every sheriff's department in the nation. 18,000 sheriff's department. Each one of them, if not in its entirety, is an army. They all have these specialized SWAT teams. Special weapons assault teams. That's what that means. SWAT. For use against Americans. And not for bank robberies and hostage situations, but for serving warrants all day, every day, in every state of the union. Over unpaid parking tickets, over braiding without a license, over smoking a little bit of pot, over anything. No-knock paramilitary SWAT raids, including, constantly, including innocent people killed. It's madness. It's national suicide. I mean, what group of Americans hates the other Americans so much that you would have this done to them, to yourself, to your own neighbors, your own community, that you would unleash militarism at home like this? And the only people I hate that much are the cops, the ones that enforce it, the state, the politicians that send them out there to do it. And of course, the rent-seeking welfare parasite corporations that manufacture the jackboots and the shiny costume badges that they all wear with their pretended authority as they kick in people's doors, kill them in their beds. And anyway, here's some more cop stories for the end of the show here. Here's they used an MRAP and a tank on a drug raid, a giant MRAP, a militarized homeland security vehicle, on a local drug raid in Brooklyn last night. Here's the cops stealing millions of dollars under civil forfeiture. They pull people over. They just steal whatever cash they have. You have virtually no right in practice to sue and get it back. And this is, of course, abuse that's been going on for decades all across the country and continues. Here's the dash cam footage of the cop that shot the old man for getting his walking cane out of the back of his truck. Lucky didn't kill him. Listen to the cop cry that he might get in trouble for it. Cops entrapped teenager, autistic teen, and drug sting at high school.